Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to turn the conference over to your host, Ms. Terry Straub. You may begin.
Okay. Thank you, operator. And thank you to all of you who have joined this call on this beautiful day. We do appreciate it, and we continue to move forward with the perinatal conference calls and appreciate your continued participation. In the sub-conference room, we also have Lorraine Ryan from Greater New York, Gina Shin, Sean Cavanaugh from United Hospital Fund, Andrea Hoberman from United Hospital Fund, Dr. Brian Wagner from North Shore LIJ, and Dr. Claudia Ravens from Forest Hills Hospital. We thought we would start today's conference call off with a little bit of update on some of what we're finding on the site visits. To date, we've completed about 10 site visits, and we have another 10 in the queue for the month of July. So they are very we are moving forward with those site visits. It's challenging getting to all the hospitals, but we've learned quite a bit on the site visits. We want to thank those hospitals who have hosted us and educated us about the perinatal setting and the challenges that you face on a daily basis. As one of the issues that we found on the site visit was we kept hearing over and over again from each hospital that big challenge you are now facing is the aging parents and obesity. In many of these cases, just anecdotally, we have no data on this. Hospitals have stated that many of the patients who end up with hemorrhage, sepsis, or babies with shoulder dystocia tend to be from the obese mother because there are challenges with determining gestational age and other factors as simple as having the right blood pressure cuffs at hand or the right table to examine the patient or to administer anesthesia. So we asked Dr. Ravens from Forest Hills Hospital and her colleague from North Shore LIJ, Dr. Brian Wagner, to talk about some of these challenges, what they're finding, and then as a group to just talk about are there any evidence-based practices already in existence that could easily be applied to the perinatal setting from other settings in the hospital, such as DVT prophylaxis. So that said, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Ravens. We're going to spend about 10 minutes, Dr. Ravens, on talking about some of these issues, and then I'd like to hand it over to Dr. Wagner to talk a little bit about his perception, and then we can talk about some of the next steps that we can address with this particular issue. Ravens?
Yes. I think that one of the things that's really important to put it all into perspective is that we have to begin to consider the obese patient as a high-risk situation. I think that many people come into labor and delivery and they are obese and they have never been identified as having a potential high-risk situation. And then all of a sudden you find yourself with an apneic patient, a patient who can't tolerate being supine, a patient whose IV access is difficult to obtain, et cetera. And from that point on, then everything goes downhill. So I think that for us to speak about the labor and delivery process itself, we also have to have measures that identify these patients beforehand and that we have to work to have the, let's say, attendings out in the community understand how to identify the patients and then start the preparation for what will be ultimately labor and delivery. One of the things that we have to understand is that we're heading into an epidemic of obesity, and it's worldwide, not just the United States. But in the United States alone, one-third of all women are considered to be obese. The obesity itself and its impact on pregnancy and on the delivery process is important to understand as we have an increased risk for preterm delivery, an increased risk of 1.4 to even 20-fold in some studies that I read of gestational diabetes, preeclampsia anywhere from 2 to 10 times higher than the non-obese population, eclampsia, macrosomic infants, which, of course, are at increased risk for shoulder dystocia, and perinatal death, low Apgars are higher. Cesarean section delivery in some studies that I read anywhere from 2 to 5-fold the non-obese patient, which, of course, leaves us with a possibility for excessive blood loss, infection, thromboembolic phenomenon. The obese patient also may have an increased risk of up to twice as much for congenital anomalies, of which spina bifida is high up on that list. So I think that we need to identify the patients first, starting out in the community, and we need to make our attendings aware of that. Now, if we go forward, we should identify those patients as having elevated BMIs, let's say mild obesity defined as 30 to 34.9 of body mass index, 35 to 39.9 for moderate, and morbidly obese as greater than 40 for BMI. So if we look at all these numbers, believe it or not, as you go through all the information that's out there, even at 30 BMI, they're at increased risk for the gestational diabetes, the hypertension. And, of course, by the time you get to the morbidly obese, then we have many more percentage points where those occurrences may happen. Now, one thing that's going to be very important is that once identified, these patients then must have, let's say they have a history of apnea or snoring. Pulmonary function tests could be something that they could have as an outpatient. Cardiology may become involved if there's even a hint that there is other cardiac issues. But most importantly, anesthesia consultation prior to the person coming into labor and delivery. In some cases, 28 to 34 weeks, let's say, these people are at an increased risk for preterm deliveries. And in some cases, we should obviously go by history and bring them in even earlier. They must meet anesthesia. Anesthesia has to be appraised, or they must know if the person can tolerate being supine. If they've had pulmonary function tests, they should test them in the supine position as well. So it's important that anesthesia gets to know them. And in a group, for example, in our hospital, where, you know, it's a small group of anesthesiologists that will be covering the labor and delivery, they can talk amongst themselves as to the patients that they anticipate will be coming in and approximately when they'll be coming in. These patients for anesthesia present specific problems or challenges. Patient positioning becomes very important. Regional anesthesia, they may dislodge their catheters. Just the placement of the regional anesthesia itself is an issue because the landmarks are skewed. Their airways are extremely difficult to maintain. We would like to keep early epidurals if possible in case the person needs it, obviously, for pain management, but also because of the challenges in placing the regional anesthesia and also the possibility that this person may wind up having a cesarean section. They should have on board LMA, fiber optic capability, cricothyroid trays. If possible, we should try to see if two anesthetists could be possibly in the room with these patients at the time that they're requiring anesthesia. So the pre-anesthesia talk is going to be very important, particularly when they come into labor and delivery. Now, one of the things that we don't really consider, because most people are so young, we really don't do much in terms of getting EKGs on this patient beforehand, and that is very important. So both the pulmonary function tests, which we could get and we could possibly repeat prior to their delivery date in the third trimester, as well as EKGs, are something that we should be looking at. Now, one of the important things that you just touched on is that the possible risk of pulmonary embolus, deep vein thrombosis. We need to develop these topics or even protocols because the risk for maternal death is, let's put it this way, 35% of all maternal deaths were in the obese, and out of that, the main cause of death was pulmonary embolus. So in many different studies that I read, they had an automatic prophylaxis for the obese patient, particularly postoperatively. Also, we have to realize that, for example, if we have an obese patient and she's had previous cesarean section, her rate of VBAC is lower than in the non-obese patient. VBAC, for example, in the morbidly obese patient is only about 13% versus 60 to 80 in the non-obese patient. So we should be prepared for having a repeat cesarean section if necessary. And again, it's the important thing that if we're going to be repeating cesarean section on an obese patient, early anesthesia so that we can try to avoid the general anesthesia if possible. But then we get into all the other problems with the positioning of the patient on the table. Our tables must be wider. Our tables should be able to accept a weight of approximately, hopefully, 200 kilograms, let's say. We should have multiple access points because they tend to blow their IV lines. It's also harder to get an IV line. And if you're in an emergency, it's sometimes impossible to get the line. So we need to prepare for that. In terms of equipment that we should keep around, obviously the appropriate beds, stretchers that can carry greater than 200 kilos, the birthing beds, should be able to have as much width as we could possibly have, as well as our wheelchairs. Our wheelchairs should be able to have the same capacity that a bariatric patient should be able to have. And some wheelchairs can actually go up to 300 kilograms, yet we never seem to find those in the labor areas. Large belts should be kept around for fetal monitors. Also, monitoring becomes an issue because we do not have sometimes the ability to find the baby through all the adipose tissue, whether it's in terms of positioning or also in terms of just being able to place the monitor and have it stay. So sometimes we're kind of forced into placing all internal monitors, otherwise we can't monitor the baby. So that's something that we have to be aware of. The potential for using pneumatic stockings, the obese pregnant patient tends to, believe it or not, labor longer and actually stalls in labor more than the non-obese patient. So if they're going to be at bed rest, pneumatic stockings may be something that we could have in our labor rooms and available for the patient. Of course, we also have to make sure that the size of the pneumatic stockings is appropriate. The other thing that we could do is, let's say we understand that a great number of these patients may wind up with cesarean section. We have to be very careful in terms of the cesarean section because we have a problem in exposing the area where we'll be operating. So the penis itself becomes a big challenge. Now, in some studies I read, there was a tremendous amount of necrosis of the penis found post-operative cesarean section because of the way that the penis had been handled during the cesarean section. We could develop or would start to use some of the retractors that we use for bariatric surgery to hold the tissue up so that there isn't so much retraction, whether with the hands or with the routine retractors that we use. So that in itself is an issue. Anesthesia must be made aware that, for example, drug dosing can be very different in the patient who was obese versus the patient who was non-obese. So we need to work with anesthesia for them to deliver an appropriate amount of medication to the patient. The other thing is that in some of the studies that I read, actually from Australia, they always keep a hover mat under the patient the moment that the patient comes in. It's kind of like an inflatable mat that can be used to roll patients in an emergency. So if a patient is going to be at bed rest, they keep a deflated mat under them. And if the patient's going to have epidural, they absolutely must have the mat under them. In case there's a problem immediately thereafter, they can mobilize the patient very well. The other thing is that we must have aspiration, very strict adherence to aspiration protocol, Reglan, Bisitra, Zofran if necessary, for the patients to avoid this complication. We actually had a recent complication of a very morbidly obese patient in terms of aspiration, which is where we started to discuss within our own setting how we would develop our protocols to handle the obese patient. Geeta and I were talking about, you know, what are the at least minimum things that we could do at this point, which is bring the patient in earlier, make sure that the pre-anesthesia consultation is made, make sure everyone is aware of the potential for this patient to have a cesarean section, or in our case, it was a repeat C-section, and to have all the stockings available to immediately start on DVT prophylaxis thereafter. So the other things that we need to think about, so we've gotten through, let's say, surgery, and we have a potential for infection that's higher, seromas that are higher, endometritis. These are all complications that come from cesarean section, more in the obese patient than in the non-obese patient. We need to consider the postpartum area as well, because this is a great opportunity for the patient to now be slightly sedated and in complete supine position. She's apneic, and that's where we can have, God forbid, a real crisis in terms of this patient breathing. So we have to identify these patients who are, let's say, presenting with snoring history and say, okay, these patients will not be going to our regular postpartum room, but rather will be kept here in our holding area after the cesarean section to be monitored more frequently. And that way we can keep an eye on them, make sure nothing happens to them at that point. In terms of other complications, 1 in 10,000 of our obese pregnant women will have a myocardial infarction. So I think it's very important that our staff understands that these may not be typical presentations or complaints of an MI. We have to have a generalized awareness that this is, again, even if this is a 24-year-old patient, we cannot treat her as though she's the same 24-year-old non-obese patient, but rather treat her as though she's a high risk. In terms of the future, I think that the postpartum area will become a very important center for weight discussion and weight management. We should try to create groups amongst the patients themselves and sit down and have conversations with them postpartum, because they must be made aware that they are extremely high risk, and not only themselves, but rather the infant will now acquire many of their risks, diabetes, hypertension, etc. Also, the child, should it be brought up in the same atmosphere, may have poor diet, the fact that the mom may have just had a cesarean section. Sometimes because of pain, the mom chooses not to have breastfeeding or not to have the child breastfeed. And, again, we start off the cycle on the next generation. So these are the few things that we were thinking, is that we wanted to bring our patients in early, but we want our attendings to understand that this is not just a large patient. This is a patient with a very high risk factor, that the risk factor is high for cesarean section, and that discussion of cesarean section and appropriate anesthesia should occur in the office. They should come in for their pre-anesthesia consult. They should be made aware. Anesthesia, the moment the patient arrives, anesthesia should be notified. They then are in the in our labor and delivery area. We should consider that a person who's, let's say, remote from the delivery should have their pneumatic stockings. We should consider that we should have perhaps one IV line and perhaps an extra hep block line, and that we should have the appropriate anesthesia trays, the cricothyroid, the LMA, et cetera, fiber optic, available to us should the need arise. But these are things that we should think of beforehand, and that should she require should she have a vaginal delivery, and we are suspecting a macrosomic baby, we should have at least two of our attendings present in case shoulder dystocia should occur, and our staff should be on high alert for the possibility that this will be a shoulder dystocia.
Thanks so much, Claudia. That was a great summation. Dr. Wagner, do you have anything to add or any thoughts on the issue, given your experience?
I think, again, that was a really excellent overview of the topic. I think the most important thing that Dr. Rabins brought up was that identification of the patients early, because we found that in many cases the problems arise when they show up unexpectedly into labor and delivery or triage, or show up unexpectedly to emergency rooms where we have been unprepared to manage the complications of obesity. So again, I think again the most important point is identification early in pregnancy, so that we can address many of these issues hopefully preemptively to prevent some of the complications that occur with this. I think too that you know, we're lucky in the fact that we're a large hospital and have many services to collaborate with, but sort of we're in the process of trying to engage our bariatric surgery colleagues to talk about looking at some of these patients in prenatal care, sort of how they look at their patients preoperatively for surgery. Like, are there certain things that should sort of automatically push patients to pulmonary consults or cardiology consults? I think it's clear that most of us would agree that anesthesia consults before delivery are appropriate to these patients, but what criteria should push us also to get sort of mandatory evaluation by pulmonologists or cardiologists in these patients? So we're sort of working with them to hopefully look at what they are expecting preoperatively for their patients to decrease the risk, that we can also sort of adopt that into our patient populations that we're seeing also. And again, I think too, since she pointed out so nicely the increased risks of aspiration, hemorrhage, shoulder dystocia, DVT, and thromboembolic disease, that, you know, many and most hospitals have already very good protocols in place for these things, and that sort of identification and initiation and then just strict adherence to these protocols can also help to sort of decrease these expected complications for many of these patients. So again, I think the most important thing is identification. And then to collaboration with other consultants in these areas if the patients present challenges. I think too, something that we haven't really experienced here, but something that if you're in a smaller hospital that maybe doesn't have the resources of, you know, a bariatric environment with larger beds, larger clothing, necessary personnel, that maybe, you know, transfer to a different facility or a higher level facility may be appropriate in some of these patients early in their prenatal care also. So I don't think I really have much more to add besides that. Dr. Ravens did a wonderful job of summing all this up.
Terry, this is Lorraine. Is Donna Williams on the line? Can she, does she have speaking capacity?
Gina did try to reach her for that, but if not, Donna, if you're on the line, operator, could you give her instructions for speaking?
Yes, ma'am. If you'd like to ask, if you would like to queue up for a question or anything, press 1. She needs to press 1.
Okay, star 1 or just 1?
Just 1.
Okay. Donna, if you're there, and then operator, maybe you could put her in the subconference room if she is on the line.
Yes, ma'am. One moment.
Yes.
While we wait, this is Lorraine Ryan from Greater New York. This is an area, and thank you to both physicians who just presented a very comprehensive overview of many of these issues and challenges. ACOG has also been looking at this issue along with a number of other clinical issues and attempting to collect what is already out there with regard to protocols, procedures, if you will, that hospitals have considered in approaching these kinds of patients. Donna, are you there?
The line is open.
Donna?
Yeah, she may not be on the call. I don't want to misstate where ACOG is going, but it is something that we are working with them on in order to help you all have sort of a standardized, comprehensive approach to managing these patients. So unfortunately, Donna isn't here today, but I just wanted to let you know where ACOG is. And with regard to the collaborative, and we'll get all your comments in just a second, we're, you know, for today's purpose, we wanted to hear what some of the challenges are, but going forward, we want to help you get at the solution. So many of you may have already thought about these issues, and why don't we just take your comments, and then we can discuss more where the collaborative will go in the future.
Operator, you can open up the lines for questions or comments. Operator, are there any questions? Operator? Operator? I think we
yes, ma'am. One moment.
Okay.
I was trying to open up the first question. I apologize.
Thank you.
Our first question is from Katie Stevens.
Hi, Katie.
Oh, thank you, Katie. ACOG.
Katie?
Okay. Our next question is from Yolanda Neves.
Hello, yes. Yolanda.
Hi, it's Melanie Somersill. We're here at Brookdale.
Hi, Melanie.
I had really a question for the two physicians, and I really appreciate the thoroughness of the presentation. It was really excellent. However, one of the challenges that we would have, as I'm sure many other places will have, is initiating some of these preventative suggestions in terms of early admission and pre-anesthesia consult in determining who that really should be offered to. Initially, I'm looking at it that, you know, maybe we should be targeting the morbidly obese because it's manageable. But if your suggestion was really that we do this for all obese patients, I could see that we would have 50% of our patients coming in for this and it becomes unmanageable. Is it reasonable to target the morbidly obese patients and work backwards from there?
I think the morbidly obese patient absolutely has to be seen prior, have a pre-anesthesia consultation, and possibly even pulmonary clearance. But from what I saw of most of the studies, all the really severe problems that we just discussed actually begin with a BMI of 35 and over. So I think you're going to have more than just the 40 and over. I think you're going to have the 35 and over. Each percentage point or each point of the BMI leads to a greater percentage or a greater severity of disease. For example, one of the ways that you can do is you look at the person. There's a difference between, for example, the distribution of fat on the body that leads to certain complications of the pulmonary system versus cardiac. So there's a gynecoid distribution, an androgynous distribution, and I forgot what the last one is. You measure the buttocks. But the bottom line is that each distribution is different. So it's not just the BMI. I think all the morbidly obese patients, they for sure need to be seen. But if you want to choose from the other two for the BMIs of greater than, let's say, 30 to 40, then you should look at the fat distribution, because what you're saying is true. And it's anticipated that by the year 2050, 50% of everyone is going to be obese if we continue with our trend. So it is going to become not really manageable. Most of the work, though, is being done on an outpatient basis. So let's say you do have the good fortune to have a young patient who happens to be obese, yet she can lie supine without desaturating. She has no cardiac problems. So those may be the patients that just the anesthesia consult would be appropriate. By the time you're morbidly obese, you have so many other issues that usually they, even if they are young, they still need to have the anesthesia and many times also the cardiac clearance, because during the pregnancy, a lot of them will present with basic things like shortness of breath. How do you know that that person is not having, let's say, emboli if they're short of breath and happen to be obese? So I think those are the people that no matter what, they're still going to need to be seen by cardiology beforehand. But I think that in terms of just the hospital itself, like what I would like to see here is that We have the patients. She comes in with a BMI of whatever. That's identified by the nurse as she's coming in. That person already has, like, let's say, a copy of her pre-anesthesia consultation. So this has already been taken care of on the outpatient basis, sometimes even 10 to 12 weeks before. Okay? I don't know if that helps you out with Brookdale in terms of the numbers, and I'm not sure if it's mostly a clinic population and it has to go through your clinic, or if the patients are just coming in primarily in labor and not really having, let's say, a very good lengthy prenatal experience in the clinics.
We have pretty much 50-50, whether they're coming from our clinics or they're self-referred. So again, we're clear about what to do about the morbidly obese patients, and I think what you've suggested is that the patients with BMI between 35 and 39.9, we can look, and if they're the pear shape, we're not as concerned, but if they're the apple shape and they have any other symptoms, whether it's shortness of breath or desaturation or certainly a history, then those are the patients that we will also have to put into that early intervention and preventative group. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Next question.
Our next question is from Steven Schuster. Your line is open.
Hi, Dr. Schuster. As part of the program here at New York Hospital for some years now, we've had, first of all, a full-time OB anesthesiologist and a group who are dedicated to OB, and secondly, all prenatal patients, whether they be service, group, or voluntary staff, singles, are asked to send patients in for anesthesia consultation, not just patients who have been identified as possible risk patients for obesity or other things. And I think we found that by that means, the anesthesiologists become, first of all, more part of the team, and second of all, occasionally and not infrequently, pick up things that have not been picked up previously. So then early on, that's done. I think the challenge is exactly what Melanie mentioned and Dr. Ravens also noted, and that is making sure that the patients get in. Just because you make a requirement doesn't mean that it occurs. So, but a nice presentation, and I think it's certainly timely. Thank you.
Thank you. That's great that you have that service available.
Our next question is from Donna Matalta.
Hello, Donna.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Donna.
Okay, great. Sorry, I was on before, and unfortunately, I don't think the operator could unmute our line. So, Lorraine, what was it that you wanted me to talk about?
I just wanted to give you an opportunity to mention where what ACOG has done in this area thus far and where you see yourself going and hopefully in conjunction working alongside of us at Greater New York.
Yes, definitely. There's been a series of educational pieces that that ACOG has put together, and they're available if anybody on the phone would like extra copies or anything, but they should. Many of the ACOG fellows and junior fellows have seen these already. As you know, hemorrhage was one of the first educational pieces that we brought out of the Safe Motherhood Initiative, and we did an alert, and we are actually reissuing that alert with the commissioner, as well as the posters, and I think we talked about that on earlier calls of this group. In addition, we did do a brochure called Managing Maternal Obesity, a Guide for the Prevention of Maternal Morbidity and Mortality, and in there it talks a little bit about the ACOG recommendations for obstetric management of obese women. It talks about bariatric surgical procedures, exercise and pregnancy, weight gain, weight control with the patients, and we also have available obesity grand rounds. If anybody's interested in those, we have faculty that will give those. In addition to that, we have our preconception care poster and flyer that we've sent out, and that we have recently done an extra distribution of that. The Department of Health put it in color, which is a really pretty piece, and there is a paragraph under chronic diseases that talks about obesity and what obstetricians should be aware of when they talk about preconception care. And then lastly, we have our pocket card, which is a laminated piece on the components of preconception care. And again, that talks about healthy weight management and lifestyle. So that's what we have right now. We're working, we're coming out with a critical care piece. We have education grand rounds on all of the topics that I've talked about so far. And we'll be doing some work on obesity related to hypertensive disease.
Thank you, Donna. If folks are interested in the educational rounds, how does that process work?
they need to contact Katie Stevenson in my office. Katie's on the call with us today, and just ask for grand rounds, and we'll do it. We'll bring it right to them.
Great. Thank you, Donna.
Thank you, Donna.
I want to mention that this topic links very closely with some of the outcomes found in the Safe Motherhood Initiative, the Mortality Review. And we are holding a conference on September 22nd. ACOG will be participating along with some of its physician reviewers and discussing sort of the root causes of many of these cases. And obesity is one factor along with all the other comorbidities mentioned that are associated with obesity. So this is a bit of an advertisement or commercial for all of you to attend that meeting on September 22nd.
Yes, in New York.
In New York City, at Greater New York.
Operator, do we have any other questions or comments?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the 1 key on your touch tone telephone. I'm not showing any further questions at this time.
Okay, great. And thank you to both of our speakers today and the team from Forest Hills for addressing this issue and highlighting some of the areas that protocols already exist in that can easily be transferred into the perinatal setting. And I think it was very interesting comments made by Dr. Rabins, and I know when we spoke to Dr. Fleischer and the folks at LIJA and Dr. Wagner, the relationship that you're building with the bariatric surgery team, because they do have all of this equipment and they do have larger OR tables and equipment available that could probably be shared with the OB folks in the cases where you have actually elective C-sections, or if that OR is actually available, the bariatric OR, when some of these morbidly obese cases come in, that you could actually use that setting for the delivery. So I think that's very, very creative to share services and service lines. So thank you both. Moving on, we're going to go in and talk about some of the data. And I'm going to ask Gina to review both the data and the NCC products that are available. Gina has been working very hard on pulling together the data elements along with Rafael Ruiz from Greater New York, and also a lot of follow-up has been done with the NCC certification piece. So, Gina, do you want to get started?
We recently held another outcome measures work group meeting actually last week just to finalize our list of indicators that we would like to collect from each of the participating hospitals. The work group suggested in terms of maternal measures, uterine rupture, return to OR, third and fourth degree lacerations, and blood transfusion. In terms of the neonatal measures, we decided to look into intrapartum or neonatal death, birth trauma, and APGAR at less than 7 at 5 minutes. What we're trying to do is to see if we can obtain some of this information from the SPARKS data so that we don't add any more data collection in terms of the hospitals, since we know that a lot of you are already collecting a lot of this data for different organizations. We will be looking more into this, and we will update you when we have further information. In terms of the NCC examination,
so
many of the hospitals have shown some interest in using the NCC exam to...
Gina, before you get into that, can we just open up the conversation on data meds?
Yeah. Operator, can you open the line for anyone that has questions?
And just as some background, these measures were identified by representatives of your institution. Certainly not every institution was represented, but we did go to the clinicians on our perinatal advisory panel, clinicians and other professionals, and looked at what was being collected in other parts of the country that have initiated successful perinatal safety programs and have worked very much off the adverse outcome index. Developed by a risk management and quality improvement organization, and that has really found to be quite useful and telling in terms of its results. So we don't want you to think that we kind of just made it up as we went along. We have sought input, and as Gina mentioned, we are attempting to get at these data elements outside of your own organizations. We know that you're reporting these externally, and we're trying to get them that way so that it's really sort of a seamless transition. And how often we look at these measures will be determined really by the source of the information. At this point, as Gina mentioned, we're looking towards SPARKS data. Almost all of the measures are being reported into SPARKS. With SPARKS, there is somewhat of a lag time, as you all know, and there's also the whole issue of the accuracy of the coding dictates the validity and the credibility of the data. So those are some of the issues that we're facing. And any questions at this point or comments, we'd love to hear from you.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or a comment, press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone. I'm not showing any questions or comments at this time.
Okay. Thank you, operator. Gina, carry on.
So we did some background. We looked up some background information about the NCC exam. So we just, I just wanted to share that with you. You also have attached in your email an outline of the NCC exam process. So you can look at that as well. So there's essentially three ways to take the test. The first way is a computer-based test, which you can pretty much take any time during the year at one of multiple testing centers throughout New York State, New Jersey, or Connecticut. The fee for a computer-based exam is about $185, and what you would essentially have to do is submit an application to determine your eligibility, and once you're determined to be eligible, you have a 90-day window to schedule and take the exam. The second way to take the exam is by paper and pencil, but this is only provided once a year, and there aren't official testing sites for this. What you would have to do is apply to be a testing site with six other candidates, and then once you're determined eligible, you can take that exam on that specific date. The fee for a paper and pencil exam is about $135. The third way that you can take the exam is for your hospital to become an institutional certification plan program. And if your hospital participates in the ICP program, you can either, with a minimum of 25 examinees, become a testing site, or with a minimum of 100 examinees, you can actually get a testing fee or a discount on your testing fee. What you would have to do is basically apply to be an ICP and then also provide a court testing coordinator. In terms of as an ICP, you can basically take the test anytime throughout the year in a 3-week period, that's basically it for the ICP, but in terms of the test itself, it mostly covers pattern recognition, interpretation, and intervention, but there are a few other topics, including the electronic fetal monitoring equipment, physiology, and legal aspects of EFM. NCC doesn't provide any type of review course or study material. Once you are determined eligible through your application, they do provide a candidate guideline, but that pretty much just goes through the testing process and also provides a few test questions just so you can prepare for the exam. But for more details, you can also check the NCC website at www.nccnet.org. And we also will be having a conversation with an NCC representative tomorrow to ask some of the questions that you might be interested in. So we would love to hear from you to see if you are interested in taking the NCC exam and if you have any other questions. Operator, can you open the lines for any questions?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. Our first question is from Steven Schuster. Your line is open.
All right, thank you. I'm interested in many of these programs, so I'm exploring almost as many as I can get into my hand. And the problem that we most face in our institution is getting the doctors in the seats. And so that is the voluntary doctors. And although we're planning to link it in some way to privileging and credentialing, it still remains an issue to do at a time when they're sort of besieged by so many other problems. And the NCC program, as I see it, has several areas, and I would hope you would ask the representative when you speak to them tomorrow, several areas that they have to enter into before they can actually get into the program. They have to request the study material or decide that they're smart enough already and not even do the studying. They have to either have to come to a site at a time that's determined previously by the site, whether it's done in the hospital or outside the hospital, to do so. So I would just wonder whether they have explored the possibility of putting the program online, whereby it could be taken online and study material provided them in advance of it so that they can feel that they're doing it at their own pace and be able to run for a half an hour and taking the test and then break away and then come back again another time. Although we all appreciate its importance, we're also trying to be user-friendly as we can to the besieged physicians, myself among them. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Schuster. It is web-based, but we will see if you can walk away and come back to it, because they do seem to have a two-hour limit. But we will follow up tomorrow on the call.
Our next question is from Cheryl Robb. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Cheryl Robb from Yale New Haven Hospital, and I can kind of answer that question for you, as we have utilized the MCC procedure and testing here at Yale. And we asked that very question when we started the process. And basically their answer is no, it can't be offered that way because they are a standardized national exam. So I hope that helps answer your question, but they said no to us.
Well, it answers the question. It just wasn't the right answer, Cheryl.
I'm sorry it's not. But I think to address some of the issues, because I am the coordinator who does it here at Yale, when you sign up for the ICP program, you can decide when you're going to give the exam. You're given a three-week testing period, and I, as the coordinator, can say, in those 3 weeks, I'm going to give it 21 times, or I can say I'm going to give it one time. So if you have the right coordinator, you can facilitate those volunteer physicians you're talking about, because we did mandate it. It was linked to credentialing here at Yale, and all of our community physicians did have to go through it. And I bent over backwards to make sure that I could give the exam when it fit their purposes, because I know it's difficult for them.
That's a great point, Cheryl. It's the flexibility of the coordinator.
Absolutely. And having more people that can proctor the exam. I was doing it basically myself.
Very helpful. Thank you. Do we have any thoughts on or comments, operator?
We have another question or comment from Stephen Schuster. Your line is open.
Hi. I very much was interested in Cheryl's comments. I'd like to figure out a way of getting in touch with her if I could figure that out.
We will send you all her contact information.
Beautiful. Thanks so much.
And just as a reminder, on September 18th, we are trying to put together a vendor fair. So we will have folks in that offer the testing as well as electronic medical records and reporting here at Greater New York. So we'll be sending out further information on that.
Our next question is from Donald Morris.
Hi, my name is Don Morris. I'm at Lutheran Medical Center. I was interested if anybody has any information on a curriculum that I can give my residents prior to taking the exam to do a little bit more of a standardization of a course, like something like the GE course or something like that. Does anybody have any information on that?
We can open up the lines. I think Cheryl actually had a curriculum that she had put together for training before taking the course or the test. Cheryl, are you still on the line?
She hasn't queued up yet. One moment.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Ms. Rob.
Okay. Yes, I'm here. Basically, the curriculum I put together was the documents that I used to study myself, and I think in the materials that Gina sent out yesterday, a lot of the things that I do give out were listed there, and some other things that I found since then. There is an online site that does have kind of what you seem to be referring to, a computer-based learning. But most of what I give out is stuff that I've accumulated along the way that I used or other people have used and found them helpful. Our residents have used all the paper documents that I've given. They haven't done any preparation online. And I think for those of you who are, you know, maybe thinking about physicians taking this, here at Yale we've had 100% pass rate by our physicians in the I've been giving it now for 3 years. Not a single physician has flunked the exam on the first go-round.
Terrific. And, Don, we will also look around for other course material, and I think during the vendor fair we'll be able to see some of the vendors who actually have some online courses that may be useful for your residents.
Our next question is from Donna Montalto.
Hi, Donna.
Hi. I just wanted to jump in here, and it's not definite or in stone, but I think I should mention, ACOG has submitted a grant proposal, and we expect to hear in about September. And we did this a joint application with a Haney's, and it is for a curriculum for electronic fetal monitoring, and it is to prepare our OBGYNs and residents and junior fellows for the NCC exam. It is a part of you might have gotten a tease at some of our previous clinical meetings we did last year, for example, in the year before at our upstate meeting. We brought in Lisa Miller and David Miller, the OBGYN, and Lisa Miller is a midwife lawyer, and they kind of talked a little bit about the prep that needs to be done for the NCC, and they also gave out strips, and they use the audience response system, and you know, folks had to kind of look at the response system and decide whether or not what they were reading was actually the same thing as the person sitting next to them, as well as their midwife and their nurse, and it was really a good program. David Miller is actually going to be speaking again at our October annual district meeting in the city at the end of October. But should we get this grant, and again, we won't know until about September, October, we will be rolling out a curriculum for EFM for, you know, obstetric providers. And, you know, we look forward to rolling that out to all the hospitals in New York. So.
And if that is the case, Donna, what would the timeline for that rollout be? And how would you, how have you proposed to administer the course? Would it be?
We would use faculty, OBGYN faculty, and some midwives and some lawyers actually to put. They would be faculty to the program, and they would travel around the state. We're hoping, I think, initially to offer it in each of the major geographic regions throughout the state, so that you know folks could get there as well as the residents could get there. Again, I don't know if we're going to get this grant, so I was a little hesitant to say anything about it. So, should we get it, we will do diligence to get the curriculum out, you know, very quickly because this is moving so fast. So.
Our next question is from Mark Callahan.
Hi, Mark Callahan here. We've got a course that we've developed that's web-based for the FOJP hospitals. That's I think we've now started the first two modules with Mount Sinai. They've gotten 185 people through it. And it includes six case-based modules along with a basic pattern recognition and didactic module, and then a post-test, and it gives a, you know, after the test, people get a certification as to passing or not. So that, maybe we should bring it to the vendor fair in September to have people take a look at it if they're interested.
That would be great, Mark. And one of the participants on the call had just emailed me while we were talking that, and it's a good suggestion, for the NCC testing, it would be a great idea to use it as a grand rounds for that two-hour period. So that's another way of getting the physicians to the table.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Mark, the FOJP product will be available to those outside of the FOJP family, yes?
He's going to need to press the one key again.
I'm not sure Mark is still on, but...
Do I need to press the one key again?
No, now you're on.
Okay. Yes, the product will be available outside of the FOJP hospitals.
Okay, thank you. And when did you say that might be available?
It should be available, the full course, by September. We've already run the first two modules through for Mount Sinai. They had an education need, and that's been fairly successful.
That'll be great to see. Thank you.
And by the way, we had a 99% pass rate on the test.
Oh, very good. Thanks, Mark.
We have another question from Steven Schuster.
Hi. Sorry to be a nudge. The pass-fail keeps being mentioned, and this is an area of some sensitivity from what I understand, so that if someone wished to access grades of a given physician, they might say, I may have mentioned this before, well, Dr. Schuster, you got an 87%, which was passing, but you missed that 13%. The problem that arose in this case that we're prosecuting, Dr. Schuster, is in that 13%, we believe.
It's our understanding, Dr. Schuster, that there's no grade. It's pass or fail.
And that's the ball game.
Yes.
Okay. One other thing. You mentioned the adverse outcome index. Is that going to be sent us so that we can see what it looks like, this revision of the AOI?
Yes, the data measurement tool?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
So refining it, and, yes, absolutely you will see it.
Terrific. We have something we may have shared with you in our QA, which are, you know, required, and I think they include most of the things mentioned, but I'd like to see it. Thanks.
We have another question or comment from Cheryl Robb. Your line is open.
Hi. Again, Dr. Schuster, in response to the comment that you just made, even the coordinator does not get the results. It is exclusively a pass-fail. When I send in the exams, I will get an email back from NCC telling me that, let's say I gave the exam to five people, five passed, or it'll say you gave the exam to five people, four passed. I don't know who didn't pass. I have to wait for those individuals to come forward and inform me that they need to retake it so that nobody but the tester themselves gets the results.
Thank you, Cheryl. I hope that puts everyone's mind at ease on that.
I'm not showing any further questions at this time.
Thank you. After today's call, we'll follow up with everyone. But before we do that, I just want to say we're still collecting information on team training needs. So that, get that to us as soon as we can get in touch with the trainers and get that scheduled. There's still quite a number of staff within each of your facilities that have not gone through the team training, and we really think that having those sessions again this fall will help reactivate some of the enthusiasm for the collaborative. So please email Gina. All her contact information is here. Lorraine, do you want to comment on the root cause analysis training?
Yeah, we've mentioned it before. We have an ongoing root cause analysis training program for any of those who may be interested. In the past, we've just offered this out to your institutions in general and haven't focused specifically on OB. We have heard about some interest in doing some OB-specific sessions from a few of you after the last call. So we're looking for a critical mass. Any of those who are interested at this point will be scheduling sessions in September and October. And just let us know. I think you have our email addresses, and we'll try to address your institution-specific needs with regard to timing. We do recommend that you send a team of staff to the training, and, you know, the whole collaborative is all about teamwork. So whomever you identify as being, you know, pivotal to the RCA process, doctors, nurses, other clinicians, and other professionals, risk management, quality management, and others, are all welcome. It's a four-hour training program that we do on-site at Greater New York. We do offer CME and CE credit for the training, and it's offered at no cost, so please take advantage of it.
Thanks. And as we already mentioned, on September 18th, we will have the On the 18th, we will have the vendor fair. And then on the 22nd, we'll have the hemorrhage protocols SMI findings. So please save the dates for both of those events. And those events are open to all of your staff. They're free, so encourage as many folks as possible to participate and become more familiar with the collaborative. If you have private attending physicians, we strongly encourage you to reach out to them and see if they'd like to join us at either of those sessions and be part of the decision-making process as you move forward with the selection of your EFM training programs. So unless there are any other questions, we will be in touch with you. We'll, again, send out the information on the data collection.
Hello.
Some of the comments from today.
I do have a question from Richard Oshowski.
Thank you, Richard.
Yes, I have a request, actually. Can we have a summary of this meeting of today sent to us in email?
It will be available on the Jenny website, so you can find the recording there.
And we'll write up some of the information. Any other questions, operator?
I'm not showing any further questions.
Thank you, and thank you all for your time. Enjoy the rest of the day, and we will be in touch with you over the next couple of weeks, and we continue to seek your feedback and response to the additional training sessions. We would like to get them scheduled as soon as possible.
Terry, just one thing. Is the August call on? I thought we were not going to have that on the schedule. I see it on this agenda. Are we scheduled for August 7th?
We are as of now. It's up to the group if they still want to have a call in August or not. Comments or thoughts from the group?
Vacation time.
Pardon, Ms. Straub, I do have a couple questions coming in.
Okay.
Our first one is from Nancy Ackman.
Yes, Nancy.
Hi, this is Maureen from Letting Sell. Can you just go over first the internet address for Jenny and the logon and the password again for us?
The internet address is www.ipro.org, and the password is hospital quality, all one word, all lowercase.
And we will send it out in a reminder email for everyone, with a direct link right to where the recordings are.
And our next question is from Donna Matalta.
You were just asking about the meeting for August, and I don't know if you can open up your lines or not, but I would say August is a bad month to get everybody together.
Right. So we'll caucus here, and then we'll get back out to everyone whether or not there'll be an August call and confirm that way. Is actually needed or not. All right, everyone have a great day. No other questions, operator?
No, ma'am, I'm not showing any further questions.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation and have a wonderful day.